The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Drazik, obviously moved by Ukrainian resistance of the Russian barbarity at its gate, takes to the keyboard, and I've retweeted it. Go and find it there. We'll play Can One Man Save the World a few times today. Good morning, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for joining. I'm on the West Coast. Three more days, going back to D.C. on Friday. And back into the Beltway, let me give you the rundown. The overnight shelling continued. There is very little hope of a ceasefire. Diplomatic efforts to end Russia's war in Ukraine showed no signs of progress on Monday, according to the Washington Post. The European Union is approving new Russian sanctions. I was told yesterday the swift exile, because it excluded banks that deal in Russian oil and gas transactions, had not been very effective in isolating Russia. Maybe EU will pick it up. Polish, Czech, and Slovenian leaders are headed to Kyiv today to meet with Zelensky and offer support. Also in the news today. And on Wednesday, Zelensky will be addressing the United States Congress on Wednesday. I think that's remotely. He's not coming to the United States. He's not leaving his people. But it's he's really quite amazing, as the song by John Andrazik, Can One Man Save the World, makes very clear what people are thinking. What does the market think of the war? I've taken to taking my optimism or pessimism about a ceasefire by consulting the European markets in the morning, brought to you by Birch Gold, of course, hugold.com. Gold this morning dropped down to 1936. That's ordinarily a pretty good sign when gold drops a percent overnight, that maybe the march north will stop for a while and breathe and the Russian tanks will withdraw. The 10-year Treasury crashed through 2% to 2.14%. Alas, overseas, England is down 1.4%, Germany is down 1.74%, and France is down 1.74%. I believe this has to do with the obvious failure of the attempt to get China on Freedom's team yesterday. I'm not surprised. I'm just not surprised. I went on Brett Baer's show last night. Brett was kind enough to have me on special report. And I got asked right out of the gate, what about Ukraine? Cut number 10.
Hugh, where do you think we are in this stage of this invasion, and what the international community is doing to try to stop Putin doesn't seem to be making a dent?
It doesn't, Brent. I think we are getting very close to clarity. We have a trio of tyrants and they're working together, Khamenei in Iran, Xi in China, and Putin in Russia. Putin dropped 8 missiles 10 miles from Poland's border this weekend. President Biden has rightly said that he would defend every inch of NATO. If one of those missiles had gone awry, we'd be knocking on the door of World War III. Khamenei dropped missiles on Erbil. We talked about that today on the radio show. And you and I both know this alliance of tyrants don't believe in the international rules-based order that Wendy Sherman was talking to you about yesterday. So we need clarity, Brett. We need to get it now. We need to get it fast. They are not our friends. There is no international order, and the West has to be clear about these three bad actors who are working together.
You know, that's just it. There are a trio of tyrants in the world, an alliance of tyrants. Khamenei in Iran is the junior partner. Putin is the new partner, and Xi is the boss. There are other bad guys around. Don't get me wrong. Maduro in Venezuela and North Korea's crazy man. There are other bad actors around, but the trio of tyrants are Khamenei, Putin, and Xi. And there's no other way around it. They came back to me to talk a little bit about what do we do next in Ukraine. Cut number 11.
That's doubtful, according to many foreign policy experts, especially after, Hugh, the weekend, this statement on Saturday from China about Taiwan, in which they write, any country supporting Taiwan militarily would face, quote, the worst consequences, they warned Saturday, adding no one, no force would be able to stop the Communist Party if it took action against the island country, according to a report. Now, you can read that one of two ways. They're getting defensive about this moment in time. They've recalculated based on what Russia is doing in Ukraine. Or this is really an aggressive posture talking about Taiwan. How do you read it, Hugh?
Door number C, door letter C, Brett. There is no reason, there is no evidence on the table anywhere that China is other than allied with Russia and Iran. I called up National Security Advisor, former National Security Advisor O'Brien today after the seven-hour meeting that Jake Sullivan had that Ben referenced. I said, did you ever have a seven-hour meeting with anyone? He said, no. I had a four-hour meeting once with one person, and that didn't go well. 7 hours, I guess they spent congratulating us for coming to the Olympics and not boycotting and making sure that New York Wall Street money came in and supported the games. There is no reason, no evidence at all to believe that China is other than hostile to us. Russia sends missiles 10 miles to, from Poland border, and Iran bombs Erbil. It was a bad weekend for people who want to believe in unicorns and off-ramps. There isn't any. What we need to do is build weapon systems and peace through strength, and we got to do it now.
That's the first thing Larry Aaron said last Friday, if you remember. The first thing we better do is build some weapons, because all the nice people in the world don't do anything against thugs and evil people. There's a great story this morning. Let me find it in my stack of stuff. I've got so many stories here. Vladimir Putin may be starting to fall out with his spies, according to the Telegraph. Someone needs to be blamed for the screw-ups going on, because Russia's not winning. They're not losing. They're going to throw everything at it. Honestly, I wake up every day worrying he's gone tactical nuclear with one of their low-yield nuclear warheads. The multiple reports, Colonel General Sergei Beseda, the head of the Fifth Service of the Federal Security Department, FSB, and his deputy are now under house arrest. So this is what happens when you get dictatorial regimes, tyrants, totalitarian regimes begin to feed on themselves and shoot each other. So that's the only good news this morning. Bad news. Israeli Prime Minister Bennett holds back-to-back phone calls with Putin and Zelensky on ceasefire efforts. Look, Zelensky will do anything that's reasonable. We know that. Putin said no. So he can say no at great length over a long table. He's just, look, he's an evil guy. Evil. They destroyed the third story. I'll bump it up. A complete maternity hospital full of babies and mothers was destroyed, leveled by Russian airstrikes that targeted it. Children and mothers are in the rubble. The Ukrainians have dug in all around Kyiv, by the way. Long story in the Financial Times on the 5 day of preparation is that absurd column that's going nowhere and keeps getting shot up by anti-tank weapons. Good old Russian tactic. Look, Russians win. They win by going over people in massive waves with conscripts. They don't lose. So we're not talking, but they're going to pay an enormous price. They already have. And the price is Russian moms and dads and wives are getting phone calls by the thousands that Ivan isn't coming home. What happened? Well, he went to Belarus for training exercises. No, he went to Ukraine and got killed because the Ukrainians were not actually what we told you they were on Russian TV. By the way, say a prayer for, I got to say her name the right way, Marina. It's not Marina, it's Mariana, who walked through the television set of Russian One carrying a no war sign. She's been missing since then. I'll be right back. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. That music means Drucker is with us. David M. Drucker, of course, is the Washington Examiner's chief political correspondent, author of In Trump's Shadow. Good morning, David. What do you think the war is doing to Putin? I mean, to Joe Biden's reputation?
Well, I don't think we totally know yet, Hugh. You know, the interesting thing about I'll just raise there's lots of polling, so I never lean on one poll. Good or bad, whatever I want it to be or think it is. But I will tell you an interesting thing about the CBS News poll that popped on Sunday is that it showed that Biden's handling perceptions, voter perceptions of Biden's handling of the war in Ukraine, Russia's invasion of Ukraine, have improved as he has taken tougher action. Now, he has taken tougher action steadily but slowly, often behind the Europeans, not as fast as Americans would like. But the tougher he has gotten, the more Americans have approved. Beyond that, I don't see that the war has materially changed voters' opinions of his overall job approval. I don't think I have not seen numbers that show that those numbers are any better or any worse. And so I think right now it's just sort of politically, from a domestic standpoint, stasis.
You know, I've got to tell you, I think that the president started out strong. He's slow to everything. Like, he didn't lead on anything, but at least he matched it. And so I thought his numbers would go up. And then he goes and gives speeches like this. Just the start of the National League of Cities speech yesterday. Cut number four, please.
And now, second big reason for inflation is Vladimir Putin and gas prices. Not a joke.
Not a joke, he says. I actually think whenever you try and do that, David, the American people shake their head and dismiss you. What do you think is the reaction to that?
I don't think they're going to react to him any differently than they've been reacting to him, which is that we had rising inflation before the war. I think Americans accept that the war is contributing to rising inflation. It was already rising inflation. And I think they're generally used to Joe Biden's rhetorical tics. And so, you know, I think it all comes down to policy and conditions.
Right? Now, I want to disagree with you a bit, David, push back a little bit here. I think people know that part of the price hike in gas is Putin's war. They cannot, if they don't know that, then they're Steelers fans. Because when you shake the world markets and gas goes to $130 a barrel because Russia's cut off, people do notice and gas prices goes up. But the attempt to lay inflation at Putin's feet is not one bridge. It's 1,000 bridges too far. We're not stupid. And I hate it when people think we're stupid and treat voters like they're stupid.
Well, I understand, but I don't think I think Biden probably tends to believe this. I mean, I think that voters probably look at Biden as okay, well, that's maybe what you think, but we just don't agree with you because we know that we had rising prices before the war. So that's, in a sense, what I was trying to say is they accept that the war has contributed to rising energy costs. They just were dealing with this before the war as well. And so it doesn't jive with where they are. Look, it's the same reason why the last president had trouble with COVID. He wasn't meeting voters where they were. I don't think Joe Biden is fully meeting voters where they are when it comes to inflation. He wasn't meeting them where they were before the war. He isn't meeting them where they are after the war on this particular issue. That politically is a problem for him and his party.
Yeah, it is. And I don't think it's going to get any better for him. Now, talk to me a little bit about the guy in Mar-a-Lago about whom you wrote your book, In Trump's Shadow. What do you discern him as saying about Ukraine?
I, for the life of me, cannot figure it out. And I'm on a mission to figure this out just out of plain curiosity. And I've always felt that Donald Trump is such an odd duck on the issue of Russia and Vladimir Putin. Because on the one hand, his Russia policy was in many respects better than his predecessor, Barack Obama. But his rhetoric on Russia and presidential rhetoric matters as a part of leadership was always horrible. And he has always been willing to jawbone everybody, from people you've never heard of to American allies to American adversaries, but it's never wanted to jawbone Putin personally. And I can't really figure out what his Russia policy would be other than, well, if I was president, they're so scared of me, they just wouldn't do anything. But that's not policy. I'm not necessarily criticizing it, but it's not policy. And so I can't really figure out where he is on this issue.
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't think Putin would have done this either because of the incalculable response Donald Trump has to things he sees on TV. He ordered the assassination of Assad once because he chemical weapon children, and Mattis dismissed that. So there's just no telling. But as he makes these statements, I'm hoping he sits down somewhere and explains it. But I've not heard an explanation why he thinks it didn't happen during his tenure and why it wouldn't happen if he had been reelected.
Yeah, I mean, there's something to be said for the sort of strength that Trump often projected, and this idea of, you know, chaos theory, which is they didn't know what he would do, and so they were afraid to do anything. But there were still plenty of bad actors doing bad things on his watch, as there is under any president's watch. And so I don't think you can lean on that for everything.
I agree. You just don't want to mess with someone who's not predictable, but you've got to articulate that argument if you're Donald Trump. David M. Drucker on Twitter, his book In Trump's Shadow, everywhere available. I'll be back, hour two of the Hugh Hewitt Show, straight ahead. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Want to play for you the panel last night. The reason I do, as you know, I left NBC in December, and the opportunity to appear with Bret Baier and the panel often is maybe the most satisfactory thing I've done on television since Searching for God in America for PBS in 1996, because it's got a huge audience and it's a serious conversation. And I like last night, Ben Domenech, Juan Williams, Bret, myself. Bret's running the show. And this is the way that you talk about stuff normally. But we've got Admiral Stavridis now. I was afraid we had a no-show this morning from the Admiral. Good morning, Admiral.
Hey, good morning. Never a no-show. Just like everybody else, just astounded by these events and trying to contribute here and there.
When you're the Admiral, you get to walk onto the bridge whenever you want, right? Listen, Admiral, I want you to do for me. I am so afraid of saying anything about the actual war, because civilians don't understand anything. And I can find one war on Twitter and I can find another war on Twitter. How is the war going? What do you think is happening?
I'll give you three big takeaways at this point. One of which is the incompetence in the Russian ground forces. I think that surprised many of us, given that they've had a lot of practice, if you will, in Syria. We thought they would be more competent, but if you think about it, what they've been doing in Syria is really a series of small troop engagements. This was a big, massive land event, and they just botched it. In particular, very bad logistics, bad generalship, Hugh. They divided their forces, too many Axis coming in, and an awful lot of conscripts, considering Russia has been trying to get away from conscripts. So number one takeaway, truly weak performance thus far, and I don't think it's going to get better by the Russian ground forces. Number two, big takeaway, of course, is the immense heroism of the Ukrainians. You know, we all expected they would fight. I had them under my command in NATO days. They were partners to us in Afghanistan. I know they have good troops and high morale. They have exceeded all expectations. And if you stop and think about it, they're the ones who's behind them when they turn around. They're looking at their children. They're looking at their spouses. They're looking at their parents. They're looking at their cities. So their morale is extraordinary and high, and they're attriting the Russians at a pretty ferocious clip. And then third and finally, Hugh, I think we hit a pivot point over the last couple of days, and it's not a good one. Instead of trying this kind of blitzkrieg to decapitate and conquer the whole country, the Russians are now turning to, if you will, medieval warfare, surround these cities, pound them into dust. They're acting more like terrorists, going into mayor's offices, dragging people away with bags over their heads. They are descending to a level of war that is going to prove very ugly over the coming weeks and months. So there's three big takeaways.
Admiral, I wrote a Washington Post column about a driver who picks me up and takes me from LAX to wherever I'm. The purpose of the column, Sergei. Sergei grew up in Volgograd, and we were talking about Stalingrad, which is what it was called when it was the USSR, and the battle that the Russians fought there. It's just a battle of rubble, but it does favor the defender, doesn't it?
It does 100%, and I'll give you another example besides Stalingrad, which is worth understanding and thinking about it. Well over a million people died in that battle. Stop and think about that for a minute. I'll give you another point of comparison, more modern one. That would be the battle for Fallujah in Iraq. Fallujah is a city of about 400,000. It's one-tenth the size of Kiev. It took the 1st Marine Division, the most capable shock troops on the planet Earth, took them almost 2 months to subdue that city, fighting road by road, intersection by intersection, building by building. Urban warfare is brutal. It does favor the defenders. It can be overwhelmed, but it requires massive fires. And that, unfortunately, is where Putin will have to go if he truly wants to subdue this capital.
I'm curious. I want to get to the classic. When civilians talk about military, they quote two people, Clausewitz and Sun Tzu. I want to get to that. But if, in fact, Putin adopts Fallujah tactics, they'll be more brutal than our Marines because they won't care about civilians. But they will also end up governing an not just a failed state, but a desert, right? That's what the Romans used to do.
Indeed. And, you know, the expression to salt the earth comes from the Roman conquest of Carthage. After conquering it and losing it a couple of times, they came back and utterly destroyed it with an intent that it would never come back again. Let's hope Putin doesn't go to that extreme. But I think there's another point to be made here, which is how difficult it's going to be for him to hold not just these cities after he's pounded them, but to hold these forests, to hold these farms, these streams across this vast country the size of Texas. And he, I don't think, has the manpower, nor does he have the financial resources. You know, Hugh, war is hell. It's also really expensive. And he is bleeding money right now. For all those reasons, he's got an enormous challenge ahead.
Yeah, I would love for someone to dub Red Dawn in Ukrainian and send it over there. Let me go to the two cliches that civilians use. And I always get the Clausewitz one mixed up. I think he referred to four axes of invasion. I heard General Keane talking the same thing. You can't have a fist when you can't have four fists, right? So where is the fist? What is it, the south coast along Mariupol and trying to connect Crimea with the Donbass?
I think ultimately his bottom line that he's willing to accept is that slice of land that goes from Crimea up to Russia itself, runs through Mariupol, runs through the Donbass. So, yes, that's an important part of this. To the north, the idea was to come in, quickly subdue Kiev, get Zelensky, execute him probably, and then connect those two vectors, one coming up from the south, one coming down from the north, and then, oh, by the way, two coming in from the east. Hey, here's the problem. When you try to attack everywhere, you attack nowhere unless you have huge numbers of forces. The Russians diluted their forces. It's bad generalship. I'm sure you heard that from Jack Keane. Hey, I wouldn't, if a War College Army colonel put that plan together, I'd give him a D. It just fell apart.
Some people are getting worse than Ds. They're getting Cs, cells. They're being sent away. Okay, the second cliche, Sun Tzu, always leave your opponent a golden bridge. And that means a face-saving way of retreat. Is there such a way here for Putin to get out of this?
I wouldn't say at this point it's going to be face-saving because the proliferation of perhaps the greatest weapon on the battlefield, and that, Hugh, is the cell phone. Everything has been videoed. Everything is on the public record. Everything has been beamed across the world. Think about trying to fight World War II as one of these dictators with cell phones everywhere, and the truth becomes a very powerful weapon. So I don't think he can save face, but I think that there is a climb down which might involve providing Russia some level of authority in that region to the southeast that we just discussed. The rest of Ukraine remains a sovereign state. To get that deal done, you're probably going to have to put Zelensky's application to NATO in deep freeze. And, you know, Hugh, everyone's going to hate that deal. Putin's going to hate it because he will not have gotten what he wants, all of Ukraine. Zelensky will hate it. He'll be the prime minister who presided over the partition of his nation. The West will hate it because to get that deal, we're going to have to give Putin some level of relief from sanctions, perhaps back to where they were, status quo bellum. Everyone will hate it, but that's the closest I can think of to a climb down. Look, we're a long way from having that conversation. Both sides are still fighting hard, and I don't see any quick resolution here.
Can I go back then and ask you two more military questions? Do they have a Marine Corps? Do they have a 101st Airborne? Do they have a Big Red One? Because I haven't seen any serious conversation of this for a civilian, and I imagine you're having those among military people. And then secondly, he sent 8 missiles within 10 miles of Poland. I said to Brett Baer last night, you know, those go off course by 10 miles, and you've got that every square inch of NATO involved. What does NATO do when a missile goes awry?
Yeah, we ought to worry about that deeply. And I kind of picture some 24-year-old Russian drinking whatever the Russian version of Red Bull is, and he's tapping in coordinates, and one of those missiles goes across that border and hits, let's say, a U.S. command post. We've got a significant number of forward deployed troops now in that region. And now Todd Walters, General Todd Walters, my relief, Supreme Allied Commander of NATO, he is going to respond. And very quickly, you're in a highly escalatory ladder. So wars begin with miscalculations. That's how World War One started, with an assassination, two sides mobilizing. Suddenly the lights go out in Europe. We've got to avoid that. And I think, therefore, in the midst of all that we're doing for the Ukrainians, we got to keep the channels of communication open with Russia. Chairman of the Joint Chiefs to his counterpart, SecDef to his counterpart, et cetera. To your first question, yes, the Russians have some elite units that have historical resonance, the 1st Guards, the 8th Tank units, but they are not at the level of anything the U.S. has. They do not stand next to the 18th Airborne Corps, the 101st, the 82nd, 1st Marine Division. Those are storied units, legendary units, who are also deeply blooded from war in Afghanistan and Iraq. We have the best troops in the world, and I would argue the best Navy and Air Force as well. And that's why Putin, in the end, is not going to, my view, across a NATO border in anger.
Last quick question, though, Admiral. If you're Putin and you look over the last 3 years in the United States, we spent $7 trillion. $7 trillion. None of it went to defense. What is Xi, Putin, and Khamenei, the triple alliance of dictators, the tyrant alliance, what do they think about that?
Well, I think for starters, they recognize that for all of our divisions here at home, which I think is our greatest national security threat, is the way in which we can't seem to come together. They must be watching this Ukrainian situation and thinking, they are kind of coming together. That, I think, ought to worry them. And number two, it's not just what we spend on defense. Our allies spend $300 billion a year. That's NATO. $300 billion is more than China and Russia combined. That's just our allies. So we have a massive, capable war machine. When we overcome our differences, nothing can stop us.
Good word to end on. Admiral James Stavridis, seeing you a lot on TV. Keep doing it. Follow him on Twitter, @StavridisJ. Admiral, thank you. Please don't forget, over at HughHewitt.com, the Give Life banner at the top for food for the poor. John Andrazik is next, America. Stay tuned.
Can woman save the world?
Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. You've heard this a few times. You've been listening to the show. It's John Andrazik, Five for Fighting's new song, Can One Man Change Save the World? I just tweeted out, when you don't have to mention the guy's name, then the song is speaking, obviously, to something that's a worldwide truth. Everybody admires Zelensky. John Andrazik joins me now. Good morning, John. Congratulations. Quite the song.
Well, thank you, Hugh. I think I've had singles that haven't had as many spins as I've heard this new song on your show today. So you're always first. I really appreciate it.
Tell us about when you wrote it, how you wrote it, and why you wrote it.
You know, of course, I've been, you know, we've all been kind of just in awe of this guy, you know, ever since he turned down our plane ticket. And I wasn't really sure, you know, what the song was. But then I see how he's really kind of pulling the West to the right side of history. I think everybody assumed that, you know, that we would manage the fall of Ukraine, but he flipped the script. And so when I was thinking about, boys, is he really going to, can one man and his will and his wife and his people increase the spine of the West? Maybe. And then, you know, as usual with these songs, they kind of just write themselves. It seems like he's writing the song or someone else is. But it came, you know, it came very quickly, just like Blood in My Hands. You know, 4 days ago, I didn't have a song. And this morning I'm hearing it on your show. And that alone is pretty surreal.
Now, what's interesting is that you did not know he would be addressing Congress tomorrow. And yet this comes out. Is it getting picked up other places? I assume it's getting picked up. It's very good. It's like Superman.
Well, it's funny you say that. When I sat down to write it, I actually started with the chords of Superman because he is a modern-day Superman. He is a living figure that we're watching. I mean, you're the history expert, but I'm too young to remember Churchill, but I've heard some of his speeches. And yes, you know, folks are reacting because I think we all see in this person something that's that we haven't seen in the West in a generation. This spine, you know, from this comedian, from this actor. So yes, it is resonating. Just because I think we, you know, we've been looking for someone like this. You know, maybe it's been since Reagan, since we've had somebody to look at and follow and cheer for and learn from. So yeah, it is reacting.
I know that you spend a lot of time with the troops, so I know you've seen courage in the men and women in the ranks and in their officer. You're talking about political leadership. Because this guy is a comedian turned election, you know, he's come from the world of theater to the world of politics, and it's the highest stake. And now he's got a target on his back, and he's acting like, yeah, you can kill me, but you're not going to take Ukraine.
You know, it's interesting. He's one of the few political figures that has us looking in the mirror. I don't know if you've done this, but I ask myself, you know, if I'm this guy, if I'm in his shoes, and, you know, my country's being attacked, and do I take the plane ticket or do I stand and go down with my country? And I don't think any of us really know the answer till we're in that position. But by doing that, he strengthens us. He shames us. He enlightens us. And he certainly inspires us. But you're right. It is so unique in a political figure in this day and age. And that's why I think we are, you know, at least for me personally, I'm so grateful to him. And every night I go to bed hoping he's alive tomorrow. Every speech he gives could be his last speech. And we're watching that in real time, which is, again, so unique and moving.
Yeah, I'm a little bit afraid about the address to Congress, that they'll GPS him on that. Now, I'm also worried about the Russian journalist who walked across the stage with the Stop the War sign, Marina or Marinia. I can't get the right spelling down. It's in two different versions. That's the real gut check, because who actually has the guts in modern media to do that, John Androsik? We don't have to, because we don't have a police state to whisk you away to the Siberian gulag that Putin is building or the gulag that China has in place. But, you know, how many news people would have those guts? I can't say that I would. I hope so, but I don't know.
I agree. And how about every single Russian citizen, you know, in Moscow protesting the war? They know the consequences. You know, I saw a Russian pilot on a video the other day, decrying the war. Every time somebody does that, their family may be at risk. Their family may be killed. And we're seeing incredible heroism from some of the Russian people and some journalists. And it really gives you hope and really shows you that, you know, it's Putin and his gulag that are doing this. You know, even his people, I think, are against him, but we are seeing truly heroic, you know, action, just like we did in Afghanistan, you know, when we saw our private folks go down to rescue those we abandoned. We're seeing the same thing with Ukraine. The heroes are standing up.
That's it. They're still here. John Androsik, thank you, my friend. Good luck in getting more people to hear this, because they're going to like it. I can tell right away when the song is going to work, and this one's going to work. Thank you, John. Follow him on Twitter, John Androsik. I'll be right back. Hour number three ahead, America. I want to remind you that our sponsor is andrewandtodd.com. They're with Sierra Pacific. They lend you money to refinance your house or buy a home, or help your son or daughter become investors in real estate by becoming a non-occupying co-borrower. They help senior citizens with reverse mortgage. They help veterans with no money down mortgages. They help you refinance. So if you need to get money out of your house or you need a whole new house, go to andrewandtodd.com or call them at 888-1172. Morning, glory, America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Jeremy Hunt is my guest. He's running for Congress in Georgia's 6th Congressional District. Second Congressional District. I'm sorry, Jeremy. Good morning. How are you, friend?
Good morning. Great to join you.
Jeremy, last time we were on, we went through your bio, but there's a portion of it that is suddenly very, very relevant. You're a great candidate. I think you're going to win in Georgia's second. Would you remind people of your service and how it took you to Ukraine?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's great to join everyone this morning. I have the honor of growing up in the great state of Georgia, and I grew up in a Christian conservative home and was really blessed for that upbringing. And when I got to high school, my parents and my JROTC instructors encouraged me to consider the United States Military Academy at West Point. And I had the honor of securing an appointment and a nomination to the academy. And I was there for 4 years learning about leadership. And I graduated, commissioned as an active duty Army intelligence officer. And here at Fort Benning, not too far from where I live now in Columbus, Georgia, is where I got my jump wing, became a paratrooper. And I got deployed. And at this time in 2016, a lot of the deployments were to Afghanistan or Iraq. And I got deployed to Ukraine. And at that time, I remember thinking, you know, I didn't even know other units that had been deployed there. But we were there training the Ukrainian Armed Forces on NATO doctrine, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, on our doctrine, training them on how the West does warfare.
And what did you learn about the Ukrainians then? And what do you make of the war as it's unfolding now, Jeremy Hunt?
Yeah, well, first, I would say that I'm not surprised at all by just the resolve of the Ukrainian people in the Ukrainian armed forces. This is not a situation like how we saw in Afghanistan, where, you know, many of the Afghani men were running and trying to flee the country and just, you know, giving up. I mean, the Ukrainian people, they have such a thirst for freedom. And I saw this even when I was there. They are not going to give up their homeland without a fight. And I think the whole world has seen that over the last several weeks. Just some of the stories of heroism and then the leaders leading from the front, several members of parliament and their president, you know, patrolling the streets with weapons. I mean, it's amazing. And so I'm not surprised, because I saw that kind of spirit when I had the honor of training them back in 2016 on base. No one was allowed to speak any Russian. It was all Ukrainian. They are very proud of to be Ukrainian in particular. You go to some of the local restaurants and they'll have dart boards with Putin's face on it. I mean, it is, they are very proud to be Ukrainian.
Did you do that training at the facility that received the missiles from Russia over the weekend?
That's right. That's right. Yeah. We were training at the Yavor Training Center in Lviv, Ukraine, which is the western part of the country. And unfortunately, they came under all this missile fire over the weekend. And it was just so disheartening to see the place where I live and worked alongside them just go up in flames over the weekend. And that was that particular base where we were training them. It was an old Soviet Union base. And we were training them on NATO doctrine, on the future of the country, which is joining the West. And it's so heartbreaking to see. I still have friends over there right now that are literally fighting for their lives.
Well, now, Jeremy Hunt, does that matter to the election in Georgia? Do people care that you've been there, know that, did that? I do, but the Georgia 2nd Congressional District.
Yeah, I think people care that their country, that our country here, that there's so much weakness coming out of our White House. I think people care that we have a president who completely has dropped the ball on literally every single foreign policy initiative since he got in office. I mean, a year ago, our president, his number one priority for the United States military was white supremacy in the Army. That was his whole thing. He went on this witch hunt for white supremacy, and then he gutted the military spending. We saw the huge debacle in Afghanistan that started by him. And then we just saw just how, over time, how he's allowed us to become so energy dependent on other countries and on the foreign oil. And Putin, no doubt, felt a moment. He saw an opportunity, because the whole world has now become dependent on his oil with Nord Stream 2 pipeline in Europe. And then here in the United States, Biden's first day in office shutting down the Keystone pipeline. I mean, so we see all this. This is no doubt could have – we saw the kind of writing on the wall. So to people in my district, we care about what goes on in the safety of our country. We care about securing our own borders, about strengthening our military. And those are the things I'm going to fight for when I'm in office.
Jeremy, I just posted on Twitter your website, but would you give it to people so that they can go there without having to find my Twitter feed?
Yes, please. I would love you to check us out. You can go to Jeremy for Georgia. That's Jeremy for Georgia.com. And I would love if you come check us out, join our sign up page. And we would love to stay engaged with you. We have to fight to take back our country before it's too late.
We need to get the Congress. I think we absolutely got to have the Congress, and Jeremy Hunt is a part of that. Jeremy, thank you for joining me this morning. Thanks for the bird's eye view on Ukraine. Head to Jeremy Ford Georgia, F-O-R, JeremyFordGeorgia.com. Become a part of his campaign. Welcome back, America. Hugh Hewitt on California time for the last week. Coming back to the Beltway at the end of the week. Joined now by United States Senator Tom Cotton. Good morning, Senator.
Good morning, Hugh. It's good to be back on with you. Welcome back from vacation.
Thank you, Senator. Now, you, a few years ago, authored and circulated a letter warning the Iranian regime that anything then President Obama agreed to could be revoked, and was revoked because it was an executive agreement, not binding. Are you going to author and circulate a similar letter so that the Iranians don't forget that whatever Wendy Sherman and Tony Blinken and Joe Biden give them can be taken away as soon as we replace them?
Well, Hugh, I feel like Yogi Berra said this is deja vu all over again. I believe we've been down this road before, both with this same team, since Joe Biden has basically reassembled Team Obama, but also with the Ayatollahs. And of course, they now understand that what I said 7 years ago is a simple fact of constitutional principle, that barring Senate ratification of an international agreement like this, it is merely an agreement between two heads of state that a future president or a Congress at any time can overturn. And if Joe Biden continues with his deeply foolish and dangerous pursuit of a much weaker Iran deal than Barack Obama had, which is saying something, then of course it will be reversed in the future.
Will you circulate such a letter, though?
I feel like we don't need to circulate another letter, Hugh, but the Ayatollah's got the point the last time around. We just issued a statement yesterday with 49 out of 50 senators saying that, once again, we don't support the deal, and it's not going to be binding on the United States in a durable fashion unless it's a treaty.
You know, we need to tell that, too, as well as the Russians. This morning, according to the Times of Israel, Russia's foreign minister Lavrov says Moscow has received guarantees from the U.S. on its ability to trade with Tehran as part of ongoing talks to salvage the Iran nuclear deal. Quote, we received written guarantees. They are included in the text of the agreement itself on the resumption of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action on the Iranian nuclear program, Lavrov tells reporters during a press conference with his Iranian counterpart in Moscow. What do you make of that, Senator Cotton?
Well, I hope that's not the case, Hugh, but it wouldn't surprise me coming from this gang. Remember, this is the gang that brought us the first Iran nuclear deal. Tony Blinken, Wendy Sherman, Jake Sullivan, Joe Biden, they're all back together, just in different positions. And in many ways, I feel like they view it as a point of personal honor that they have to restart this deal, no matter how bad it is, just to stick it to Donald Trump. And that they view this also as a matter of a partisan legacy. The Democratic Party has now become so deeply invested in its partnership with the Ayatollahs that they can't walk away from the table, no matter how bad the terms are. And here, the terms are going to be terrible. None of the sunsets, some of which have already expired, like the ban on the conventional arms trade with Iran, are going to be reinstated or extended. Most of the nuclear research Iran has done over the last year since Joe Biden took office is going to be pocketed by Iran. In return, we're going to lift sanctions across the board to include, Hugh, lots of sanctions that have nothing to do with Iran's nuclear program, like sanctions against the Quds Force and the Revolutionary Guard Corps, the shock forces of the Ayatollah's regime who commit terrorism and acts of aggression all around the region. And to top it off, we very well may reward Russia for, in effect, acting as Joe Biden's lawyer for the last year, since the Ayatollahs wouldn't even sit down with his own envoy. It stinks through and through.
Now, the Financial Times today carried a story that the revulsion at dealing with Maduro led to the Biden administration withdrawing the offer to buy Venezuelan oil. Can you confirm that, Senator?
Well, I hope that's the case, but again, they haven't notified Congress of that decision, if it is. I will point out how absurd it is to go to Nicolas Maduro, a man that the United States government does not even recognize as the legitimate head of state in Venezuela, to ask him to produce more oil, or to go to the Ayatollahs and hope that they'll produce more oil. There's a very simple solution here. We can just produce more oil in places like Arkansas and Louisiana and Texas and Oklahoma and North Dakota. And by the way, that would be better for the environment than the much dirtier production practices you find in places like Venezuela and Iran. But Joe Biden and the Democratic Party is so beholden to their radical eco-activists, they'd rather ask crazed theocrats in Tehran or a murderous strongman in Caracas to produce oil than produce it in North America.
Now, I love those adjectives, Senator. I was on with Brett Baer last night on Special Report, and I said the trio of tyrants that we know most about are Khamenei, Putin, and Xi, and Xi's at the top of the food chain. But that's clarity, and you can add in Maduro, and you can add in Kim Jong-un. Have people begun to understand with clarity there are good guys and there are bad guys, and the bad guys are not? I don't know why Jake Sullivan sat down for 7 hours with a Chinese diplomat. 7 hours. What, they must have gone over the Olympic sports, you know, event by event.
It's a good question, Ewell. Arkansans have never been confused about who the good guys and the bad guys are. And that rogues gallery you just rehearsed has always been known to them to be adversaries who want to topple an American-led global order that has brought the American people decades of safety, prosperity, and freedom. I wish more Democratic colleagues in Washington were clear-eyed as Arkansans are.
You know, whenever I hear Wendy Sherman and others talking about the world order of rules-based liberal international order, that's true for us. It isn't true for the bad guys. They don't believe in a rules-based international order. They believe in strength, and we haven't got it right now. Senator, I had Admiral Stavridis on last hour. I want to ask you, given that you're on Senate Intel and Armed Services, the Ukrainians are putting up a hell of a fight. We admire them. What is the situation on the ground, and do you actually have a strong belief that they can hold out much longer?
Well, the situation on the ground in many places is atrocious. You have innocent women and children in particular, since many of the men are off fighting, being shelled indiscriminately in places like now Kyiv and its surrounding suburbs. But you also have largely stalled Russian advances. It's a significant failure of our government, both the Pentagon and the intelligence community, not to recognize the Ukrainians' will to fight and the challenges that the Russians would have from a force that was too small and undertrained to poor maintenance and equipment, poorly planned out logistics strains. We had a hearing last week in the Intelligence Committee in public, our one annual public hearing year in which some of the leaders acknowledge they significantly underestimated the Ukrainians and they overestimated the Russians. And I think that may be continued to you in some of the administration's decisions not to arm Ukraine to the teeth. For instance, it's foolish, really ridiculous decision last week not to facilitate the transfer of the Polish MiGs to Ukraine. Oh. I think, again, it's driven in part by wishful thinking and overestimating what the Russian army is capable of.
Senator, if I recall correctly, when you were with the 101st Airborne in Baghdad, you led patrols in an urban setting. Do you think the Russians have any idea how to do what we did in Afghanistan and Iraq, rather unsuccessfully in Afghanistan, but more successfully in Baghdad, which is secure urban cities that are, you know, full of guns and people who hate you?
No, Hugh, I don't think that. And that's not the Russian way of war. If you look at Grozny or Aleppo, for instance, they sit in the hills, sit in the countryside outside metropolitan areas, and they shell it into submission. I would also point out, Hugh, that in Baghdad, at least the vast majority of Baghdad, it's a sprawling metropolis, much like Los Angeles, in which buildings are not very large, you know, maybe three or four stories at most in most of Baghdad. Kyiv is not like that. I mean, any person who watches television can see that Kyiv has 10 and 15 and even 20 story buildings. Baghdad did not have that. That is much harder terrain for urban operation. And I think the Russians want no part of that. That may be why they're still stalled on the outskirts and commencing the shelling. They understand that they don't have the combat power to pacify cities like Kyiv. And further to you, I'd point out the vast majority of Iraqis, you know, 25 million Iraqis, the vast majority of them were happy that Saddam Hussein was deposed. They may have wanted more security, but they didn't hate Americans. We fought a small Sunni insurgency and a small set of Shiite militias. That's not the case in Kyiv or all around Ukraine. Whatever they might have thought a month ago, 40 million Ukrainians now hate this Russian army. And you've got grandmas with AKs and moms and kids with Molotov cocktails waiting for them in Kyiv, in addition to the Ukrainian army. So I suspect they won't know part of that.
Senator, last question. Putin fired off 8 missiles that landed 10 miles from from the Polish border. That's a mistake away, a point, a decimal point in a calculation from hitting a NATO ally. Are we ready for that? Do you think Americans are actually ready for Article 5, and what do we do?
Well, we should be ready because Vladimir Putin is playing with fire. The real question is whether President Biden is ready. What we need to make clear now is if a Russian aircraft enters a foot of NATO airspace, such as Poland or Romania, we will shoot it down. We also need to make clear that if a Russian missile battery shoots missiles that land in NATO territory, we will counterfire against that battery on Russian territory and neutralize it. It's time for Joe Biden and those around him to quit worrying about what Vladimir Putin is going to do and start making Vladimir Putin worry about what we're going to do.
You know, that reminds me of Grant on Lee. Do you know that famous quote when Grant's generals worried about Lee?
I am so weary of hearing about what Robert E. Lee is going to do to us. You think he will turn a double somersault and land on our rear and both our flanks at the same time? Go back to your commands and decide what you're going to do to Robert E. Lee.
We didn't rehearse this, America. He actually knew that. Why do you know that, Senator?
Well, it's a great moment in the Civil War when Grant took over command of the Union armies and he was in Northern Virginia for the first time, and all these other generals had been beaten down like little brothers against the big brother, against Robert E. Lee, and they were obsessed about his tactics and what they were going to do in the 1864 campaign. But it's also a reminder that in warfare, you have to be on the initiative to win. You have to be on the front foot, making the enemy react to you, as opposed to sitting around and reacting to the enemy.
Do you think NATO has had those conversations? Do you think we're ready for the errant missile or the purposeful strike on Article 5 protected territory?
I'm sure those conversations have happened. There are some NATO leaders that seem to be ready to take the initiative, whether it's Boris Johnson or our counterparts in Eastern Europe. But the question is whether or not the most important member of NATO, the United States, and the American president, Joe Biden, is prepared to forcefully defend NATO's interest and send a clear message to Vladimir Putin that he should not play with fire. He should not be shooting missiles within 10 miles of NATO territory.
I hope you carry that message into everywhere, and I hope you use that Grant quote again. Senator Tom Cotton, always a pleasure. Thank you, Senator, for joining us. Don't go anywhere, America. I'll be right back.
3-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.